New words at folks here, allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Lauren.
Oh man, I got Battlefield 3.
Did you?
I broke down and got Battlefield 3.
How's that going?
Aside from the stupid Origin service, which I'd really rather do without, because I think I voiced my opinion of Origin already on a previous episode.
That I don't remember dumb. If you did or not, but I know that you don't like it.
I don't like it, because it's trying to be Steam so hard.
Oh, that's what Origin is. Okay, yeah, you're right. That's EA's yeah. Steam platform.
Yeah, which, yeah. I mean, they've had their services before, like right. EA download link service, all that stuff, and all those things were really dumb and stupid, and I didn't like them so much. But I like Battlefield 3. It's okay. It's coming. It's a lot like Battlefield 2.
That's kind of what it looks like.
It's exactly what it is. I mean, it graphical like... update, kind of different gear, get to play with a couple different toys. But I mean, it's still like I go out there with my gun and I capture points and I shoot other guys.
The vibe that I've been getting off of it is that they made Battlefield 2, people liked it, and they made a bunch of other games and no one liked them. And so they were just like, I'm sorry, here's Battlefield 2 again.
Well, that's exactly what happened.
And, like, with a graphical upgrade. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. I don't really get what all the fuss is about. I don't know why people don't just keep playing Battlefield 2.
It's new, Oren. It's new. Well, people still do play Battlefield 2.
Yeah. I don't
it's,
know.
It's the 1984 Toyota Corolla, though. I could get the, new 2011 Chevy Prism over there.
Okay. You say these words. I don't buy into games that, like, just sell you the same game over and over again. I just don't like them. They bother me. But at least you finally got it to work.
I did. I had kind of a bit of a time, which wasn't because my computer is terrible, mind you. I have a pretty, up-to-snuff machine. It's not, like, top of the line, but it's got some good parts in it and such, and I had to fiddle around with a bunch of my video drivers in order to get it to work.
Oh, dear.
Now, this isn't... because it's ATI's fault, which I have an ATI card in my machine, or my fault because I'm dumb, because I can wield a computer pretty effectively.
As a club, primarily.
As a club, answer. It's because DICE didn't optimize the game right.
That sounds real.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime, just from my perspective, if a game tells me I need to mess with my video card in order to play it, I throw it out. I'm like, I'm done. I'm not opening my video files, my video card settings for you. I paid money. I should be able to play you. I shouldn't have to mess around with my system to make it work.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously, if you have some kind of bizarre, esoteric setup, then that's different. But if you're just running a standard game and it's like, no, I'm not going to rearrange everything in my computer, stuff that I don't really know what it does, so I have no idea what else I might be affecting, But anyway, that's a rant for another time, because now we are here to talk about the Star Trek Titan novels.
Yes.
Written by who exactly?
A lot of different people, actually. There's actually a big list of them. There's Michael A. Martin, which he's done a bunch of Deep Space Nine Marvel comics, along with Andy Majels.
Mm-hmm.
He's also done the wrap-up for Roswell.
Yeah.
Do you remember Roswell at all? The TV show was on years ago. We would have been in high school at the time.
Vaguely. Incredibly vaguely.
Alright, Roswell was a series that was about Roswell contemporary time, and there's these people who come to Earth, and they're aliens, obviously, and they're living life on Earth, and Roswell is aliens.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember if it was actually a series or a miniseries, but I know Michael and Andy both were a part of...
Was one of them Superman?
No.
Because there was a show about, like, Superman living in a small town in America.
That's Smallville.
Oh, okay. Those were not the same show, then?
Those were not the same show, Oren.
They sounded kind of similar.
They were not. He's also written, Michael Martin has written a bunch of Enterprise relaunch novels. Now, I haven't read any of them myself, because typically I don't go to, like, the bookstore and look for Enterprise novels myself.
I can't imagine why not.
Yeah, who knows, There's Andy Majels, who also worked on Deep Space Nine comics and Roswell. He also coordinates and moderates a Gays and Comics panel at Comic-Con.
That's important. I'm glad we have those. We need more. We have almost
it also, no... Okay, I didn't actually know that until I started doing research for this segment we're doing today.
And these are all Bob's show notes, by the way. So, if you don't like this episode, blame him, not me.
They'll like it so much better, Oren.
Okay, that's fair. If you like it more, don't tell anybody.
You can tell me on Star Trek Online all you want, though. But I actually know that until I started doing research for this, that he was an openly gay author. And that actually explains one of the characters that we're going to get to a little bit later in the novels. That's actually not openly gay, but he's a gay character.
Gosh, now you've gotten me all excited to talk about, like, homosexuals and bisexuals in comics, because that's a whole nother topic that really deserves its own. I'm sure there are like a million podcasts on it already, but I want to give my input on that.
Well, maybe you will when we get to that segment. Maybe. I don't remember the character's name, but we'll get to it. We've also got Christopher L. Bennett, which I'm sure you know, or anyone listening to this podcast will know who he is. He's written a plethora of Star Trek novels.
I've never read a Star Trek novel, Bob.
You've never read a Star Trek novel?
No.
We can't be friends anymore.
The closest I ever came to... We've talked about this before. You know this about me. The closest I
ever came...
That's
why we're no longer friends, Oren.
Well, actually, wait. No, I guess I did... I did read a couple of Star Trek novels way back in the day that were about, like, the characters when they were in the Academy.
Uh-huh.
But since then, I haven't read a single Star Trek novel.
Okay, well, I will let you borrow my library, then. You can read these novels, then, for yourself.
Oh, goodness.
But he's, like, been a huge Star Trek novelist for, like, years and years.
Okay.
Apparently, he keeps putting out stuff every year, these really good novels. Then we have Jeffrey Thorne, who is a screenwriter, actor, and novelist. And there's also James Swallow, who actually does...
You like to call that kind of person a show-off.
Yes. Well, I mean... Thorne's stuff isn't like super awesome.
He's so talented. He can do all these things.
He's kind of mediocre,
actually.
I can
do all those things.
Then there's also... then there's James Swallow, who's actually written novels for a bunch of different sci-fi properties, including Warhammer 40K, Doctor Who, Stargate, and he's also done some steampunk novels as well.
I didn't realize there were Stargate novels.
Come on.
I guess it makes sense.
Four spin-off, like, TV shows?
There's four of them, right?
There's SG-1, Universe, Atlantis, and there's a fourth one, right?
No. There are only three.
Okay, three.
There's the movie. The movie kind of counts as... The shows technically are all spin-offs from the movie.
Well, yeah.
So
three spin-off TV series from the movie, then.
Yeah, I just never...
There have to be
I've never seen a Stargate novel on the shelf before. At least not that I remember.
You know, I've always kind of treated Stargate... Or I've always kind of thought of Stargate as kind of that redheaded stepchild of the bigger sci-fi properties like Star Wars and Star Trek and such. I've always looked at it that way, because it tries so hard to be like Star Trek and Star Wars in terms of, like, the scope it tries to bring...
I feel
it doesn't do very well.
I think that when Stargate is at its best, what it's doing is not trying to copy Star Trek and Star Wars, although it does do that sometimes. What Stargate does at its best is because Stargate is more about modern-day people, like, interacting with sci-fi. Because, like, you know, it's the United States Air Force sending dudes into a portal to another planet and, like, trying to figure out their technology. And granted, sometimes it doesn't do that very well, but, you know, in most sci-fi shows... The premise is that these people from the future are dealing with other things from the future, whereas in Stargate, it's like, you know, people from regular Earth are having to deal with alien technology and stuff in a situation that has a unique travel dynamic with the Stargates. Uh-huh. And there are certain episodes that make really good use of that, others that don't. but I wouldn't go so far as to call it the redhead stepchild. I think it does its own thing, and I wish that sometimes it would be more comfortable with its own thing. Although, arguably, Stargate Universe is kind of a reboot of Voyager, which is funny. but they did Voyager way better than Voyager actually did. So, you know, that'll be a topic of a podcast at some point, is why Stargate Universe is like Voyager. But not today.
Mm, okay. But yeah, these books, there's six of them. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, there's also the Destiny tie-in trilogy. They ran from 2005 to 2009. We haven't seen any other books that
have been
talked about.
There's supposedly a new one coming out, according to the wiki.
Really?
Yeah, I forgot what it was called, but the wiki has another book listed that's like 2012.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by this and excited at the same time, but now my hopes are really high now.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go read about this and stuff, am I going to be heartbroken?
I don't know. It doesn't really say very much about it, other than that it's supposed to come out in 2012.
Does it say who's writing it?
It does, but I don't remember.
Hmm.
Although, just a question from someone who's barely read any Star Trek novels. Is Star Trek at all like Star Wars, where they have the extended universe? Because in theory, like, all the Star Wars novels are supposed to take place in a coherent setting.
They do not have the same extended universe setup as Star Wars do. Theirs does.
Okay, that explains a few things.
Yes. There's a lot of different stories from all eras that will not match up necessarily with other things that are going on in the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that would be, like, the Typhon Pact, for instance. The Typhon Pact, it's a series of novels that has one of your favorite characters, Ezri.
Oh, goodness.
as captain of the USS Aventine.
Captain Ezri, oh boy.
Yes, and it's got Bashir in there, too, actually. For at least one of them. I haven't read too much of the Typhon Pact. But it has to do with right after Nemesis, all these alien races that are in the Federation... band together, or they're also outside the other major empires. Like, they're not Romulans, Klingons, or Cardassians, or anything like that. All these other kind of, like, minor races that we kind of see, like, throughout the series.
Like the Myrmidon?
Yeah, people like them. They band together and form their own little federation, and then try to stick it to everybody else.
Why don't join the regular federation?
Because the regular federation is dumb. That's really all I get out of it, is that they just don't want to join the regular federation, and rather fight the regular federation.
That's weird. Huh.
Yeah, maybe. Like I said, I haven't read too much of the Typhon Pact, so take what I just said, you know, with a grain of salt, but, I mean, that seems to be the overall plot of the Typhon Pact novels, is that it's like, no, screw you, Federation, we want our own little thing that's not the Federation, but the Federation.
Huh. That would kind of play into some theories that the Federation is just a human-centric empire that, like, you know, pretends to give the other races representation, but really it's just ruled from Earth. But that's I don't really like that view of the Federation. I prefer to think that the other races are well represented off camera.
So you think there's the Bilderberger group is still out there then?
Oh goodness. I prefer to think that the Federation has a high representation of non-humans, but that we can't see all that many of them because non-human makeup is expensive. And you know, we can't have a million aliens in every shot.
What about DS9?
DS9 has, like, the highest quota of aliens per shot, but those are, but, like, DS9 is mainly non-Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in Starfleet, there are still primarily humans.
It's true, you do see a lot of humans on starships and such.
Which, like, I feel like there need to be more non-humans in
Which is
Starfleet.
Something you actually get in the novels, is a lot of the crew will be aliens.
Well, yeah, because you know how much it costs to put an alien that's not human in a novel?
I don't know, how much does the cost for words these days?
I don't know, are we up to, like, 5 cents a word now?
No, I don't know, I'm not a writer. You are. You tell
yeah,
me.
Yeah, but no one's ever offered to pay me by the word. God.
Well, you can go sell your stuff.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm sure there are TV studios out there that'll buy your stuff. Come on.
There are not.
How do you know?
Because I've looked. Getting into the television business is incredibly difficult. Like, it's all from incestuous knowing people things going on. There aren't, like, applications. You don't go down to NBC and drop off a writer application.
Well, that's why you gotta go slum it in Hollywood.
No, I'm not doing that either. Anyway, we're not talking about me.
You have to lower your standards, Ori. You gotta lower your standards if you ever want to get anywhere in this world.
Yeah, probably.
Speaking of writing, it's actually National Write a Novel Month or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I've set a much less ambitious goal for myself to make it National Write a Short Story Month. because, quite frankly, I'm not at a stage in my writing where I could actually write a novel. And if I tried to do National Writing Month, I would just end up with a bunch of garbage I was never going to use. I just don't have the time. So, like, mm-hmm. But National Write a Short Story Month is very achievable for me and will give me something I can actually use. But I'm not downing on National Write a Novel Month, just so everyone's clear. I really hope everyone doing it, including a lot of my friends, are successful, and I hope you guys get awesome stuff out of it. It's a cool idea, I just can't participate in it this year.
You can't do it, I just don't want to or care.
Yeah, well, you're not really a creative fiction writer, are you?
Well, I mean, does the Foundry count?
Yeah, but not for novel writing. I mean,
I can't say I've written a novel or have ambitions to.
I mean, you don't do a lot of prose writing, is what I'm saying. Like, Foundry is definitely creative, and it's awesome storytelling. But, you know, we're like almost 15 minutes in, and we barely talked about these novels.
Well, it's about writing and such, which is part of the stuff I want to talk about anyway.
Okay.
For Titan. But anyway, starting off with Titan, there are a few things that we know to be, or we're intimately familiar with when Titan kicks off, and notably the characters. There are four of them that we know going in. One is Riker.
Very good.
Who is the captain of the USS Titan. There's Troy.
Ooh, why?
Because they're married together, Riker and Troy.
Okay.
Do you remember Nemesis at all?
I remember that there was
the scene right after the assassination.
There was a movie and there was a bald guy who wasn't Picard but was also Picard. Yes, I know that they're married. I was just being sarcastic because I don't like Troy.
Okay,
moving on.
She's the chief diplomatic officer and the ship's counselor.
Okay,
on the ship we have Alyssa Ogawa.
Uh-huh.
On the ship, who is trucking around sick bay like she always does.
Is she... I have to recall... I was always confused. Are there certain points in TNG where I remember them calling her Dr. Ogawa, but then I remember her being a nurse.
In the episode The Ruse, which has Commander Riker, LaForge, and Worf on the surface of the planet, where they suddenly get gas and Riker's the only one left over.
Uh-huh.
And it plays out as if he's lost 15 years of his memory.
Yeah.
She is a doctor in that one, I think.
Okay.
Or wait, no, I am wrong. It's Parallels where she's a doctor.
Oh,
that not was... the ruse. Disregard what I just said about the ruse.
Yeah, disregard it.
that never okay. happens. Parallels where Worf is jumping from
right. reality to reality. That would make sense, because I just can't... I couldn't remember if Ogawa was supposed to be a nurse or a doctor. But all right, is she a doctor?
She's head nurse in TNG.
Okay.
And then I believe she's also a nurse again on the Titan. It's never a detail that I really paid a whole lot of attention to. All I know is that Lissa Ogawa is there.
Fair enough.
She is there as a single mother because her husband died at the Battle of Rigel during the Dominion War, which, I mean, if you ever look at a map and how far away Rigel is from where the Dominion War was actually fought, which is along the Cardassian border, it's a long way.
Yeah, well, you know, the Dominion gets around.
It's true, the Breen get around, yeah, I'll tell you that.
Where do the Breen even live?
You know where Ferengi Space is, right?
Yeah.
They're, like, right next door, supposedly.
Are they?
Yeah. At least most of the maps I've seen, what I've heard described.
I remember them talking about, like, Breen colonies all over the place. I feel like the Breen, like, just sort of are, like, the race that sent out a bunch of, like, settlers at the very beginning, and just to completely random places, not bothering to make a contiguous state.
Something like that. I know that they refer to themselves as privateers. I know that that's a word that's bandied about.
Really?
Yep.
Interesting. Go on.
I mean, so little is known about the Breen anyway, so I mean...
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Whatever.
They may or may not have a pleasant home or frigid homeworld, depending on who we talk... Because, I mean, there's that one DS9 episode where Wei-Yun is like, their homeworld's not actually frozen. It's very pleasant. And Damar's like, well, why do they wear the refrigeration suits? And Wei-Yun's like, I don't know.
Well, Wei-Yun is Wei-Yun.
Yeah, and see, I've always felt it's more likely that Wei-Yun was just messing with Damar in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, maybe he's telling the truth. Wei-Yun's, like, tricky like that. I couldn't tell you for sure. But anyway, yeah. That just adds to the mystery of the Breen.
Yep. Then the fourth character we have that we're familiar with is Tuvok, the only non-TNG member of this cast. Yeah.
Who let Tuvok on this ship?
They did.
Alright.
Well, Tuvok actually got on board the ship later on, because he's doing, like, another deep cover type assignment on Romulus.
I guess in terms of...
He likes his deep cover stuff, because first was the Maquis, and that's how he got into trouble getting in Voyager, and then... Mm-hmm. Well, he was under Janeway's command anyway, in order to infiltrate the Maquis. Then he's doing something on Romulus.
Yeah.
In Taking Wing, which is the first novel, and he gets on board because their chief tactical officer is incapacitated at the time. He takes over tactical duties.
See,
and he remains on the ship.
I have
as
a hard time
officer.
Believing that Tuvok could go into deep cover on Romulus. He can go into deep cover with the Maquis because he doesn't have to pretend not to be a Vulcan. But like going deep cover on Romulus, he'd have to pretend to be a Romulan.
Well,
Romulan. I have a hard time seeing Tuvok doing that.
To be fair, we see him in prison.
Oh, okay. So he's not a very good operative.
Honestly, I don't remember all the details of why he came to be in the prison. It was important, though, that he be in the prison so he befriend this Reman fella, who he then becomes buddies with and brings on the ship as well. So,
So the elf became friends with an orc and brought it on the ship.
Yes, that's exactly what happens in Taking Wing. All right, so the novels in order that we have for Titan are the first one is Taking Wing, and it deals all with the after effects of Shinzon being dead and the power vacuum being created there.
You mean the death of the Star Trek franchise? That's pretty heavy stuff for a novel.
I know, right? So it's Riker's task with leading this task force into Romulan space and going to Romulus. And making sure, you know, shit doesn't hit the fan after, you know, Shinzon's dead, and make sure his power vacuum gets kind of sealed up nice and tight.
I would hazard a guess that leading a task force into Romulan space is a very good way to make sure shit does hit the fan. typically speaking...
Well, being that, you know, it is a book, shit does hit the fan.
I'm just, you know, typically speaking, the Romulans haven't exactly been understanding when it comes to violations of their borders. I don't think that leading a military fleet is a good way to make sure that nothing bad happens.
Well, you can see very much in Taking Wing, and this is something that a lot of people have been not only theorizing about, but have also read about in books like this, or on, like, Star Trek Online, where you see an obvious, you know, state of disarray.
Yeah.
You see the entire power structure of the Romulan Empire fractured and, like, just gone anyway. You know, it's divided into factions now at this point.
Okay.
Is what it is. And what goes on in the novel is very much where Denatra's got her fleet, Sela has her fleet, and they want to duke it out head to head to resolve their differences.
Why is the Federation trying to stop this?
Because it's going to plunge the Alpha Quadrant into a war. How exactly, I don't know.
The Romulans are fighting other Romulans.
It is going to be a civil war of some sort is what it's going to be, but the Klingons also get involved.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a scout Klingon ship running. Well, not really a scout ship, but it's a
scouting
Klingon
vessel.
Ship that's scouting out there is what they're doing. Well, it's actually a Katinga battlecruiser is actually what it is.
A Katinga? That doesn't sound like a Katinga. Huh. That's a funny name for a Klingon ship.
Well, it's the D7 looking one.
Katinga.
Yeah,
so it's called. That's its name?
Yeah.
The IKS Takinga? Katinga? Okay, anyway, I'm done with that. Moving on.
What's the class of battlecruiser is what it is. Okay. I mean, it's just a D7 that looks cooler.
Fair enough.
But it's called the Katinga class. But anyway, that ship's trucking around because the Klingon Empire's looking for, you know, conquest and stuff, which they're thinking about the Romulan Empire, because the Romulan Empire just had this big problem occur.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, the entire story revolves around Riker just pretty much trying to keep everybody at arm's length from each other. Yeah.
Although I have a problem with that, with the Klingon story, too, because even if the Romulan leadership was disintegrated, their military should still be in pretty good effect, whereas it was pretty well established in the Deep Space Nine that the Klingons were just wrecked by the Dominion War.
Because, they were, it's true.
You know, they'd already committed their forces to a war in Cardassia, then they got their butts kicked by the Dominion, and, like, you know, because of their whole, like, warrior mentality, they didn't have the economy to deal with a protracted war.
Klingons aren't about why, it's about why not when it comes to war and conquest.
I would just imagine, historically speaking, the fastest thing that gets any kind of, you know, civil warring parties to unite is when another nation invades them.
Uh-huh.
Just, like, typically speaking. So I just have a hard time believing that the Klingons could possibly have mounted a serious campaign against Romulus.
Well, they don't.
Okay.
Quite yet, anyway. You know, that's what the ship is out here doing, is saying, oh, man, can we actually take, you know, the Romulans now in a fight, now that there's, like, no one in charge.
Okay.
Right now is what it is. Which, you know, I think they could anyway. I really think they could. Just given how the... Yeah, power play dynamics are working between the different factions and whatnot, because they're obviously just going to be fighting each other, is what's going to happen. And when there's a civil war going on, and then another invader comes in, typically what happens is you see, especially in fiction, you see the powers that be in the fractured faction trying to work together, but it just doesn't work out.
Huh.
And, you know, either they get by with the skin of their teeth, and they have a ruined Pyrrhic Empire now at that point, or, excuse me, Pyrrhic victory at that point. With
you
their
Pyrrhic?
Pyrrhic.
I thought it was Pyrrhic.
P-Y-R-H-H-I-C.
Because it's like, it's pariah is the word that it comes from, so it's pariahic.
Pariah is outcast, though, isn't it?
Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Whatever.
We'll get our dictionary later. So it'd be very much this Pyrrhic victory, or they just lose because they couldn't settle their differences.
Okay.
That's like what you see. So, I mean, no matter how you look at it, the Klingon's going to be in much better shape if they fight the Romulans at this stage.
I guess.
Which, strangely enough, that's how it works out in Star Trek Online.
I don't buy it, but there's only so many ways I can argue that, so moving on.
Alright, so then the next book in the series is called The Red King, which takes place directly right after Taking Wing.
Oh, hold on, 1 minute. Was Taking Wing the one where the Romulans were hiding their ships in, like, a space rift?
Yes.
Okay, why were they hiding in a space rift and not just using their cloaking devices?
Because why not space rift?
Because space rifts are incredibly dangerous, and why would you put a fleet in there when you already have cloaking devices?
My understanding is that if you have, like, a large cloaked fleet hanging out somewhere, it will be detected, just because of how much just stuff is in the area.
Yeah, cloaking devices aren't worth the gold they're made of.
Well, I mean, for, like, a few ships, it works. You know, it's cool. But if you get, like, a huge mass of it right there...
I mean, why not just, like, park your fleet out in the middle of nowhere space? Like, you know, I mean, space is pretty big. I just have a hard time believing...
Because we can see nowhere space, Orin. We can see nowhere space.
Okay. All right, whatever.
Which actually, because they're hiding in this rift, they actually get sucked into a smaller galaxy is what it is. The Magellanic Cloud.
Which is a real thing, actually. We have these two little mini-galaxies kind of orbiting the Milky Way.
Uh-huh.
And they are called the Magellanic Clouds.
Yeah, I can't even say it right.
Where
they befriend this race called the Nael, who are offshoots of humans.
Wait, what? How did they get there?
I honestly don't know. The explanation they give doesn't make any sense at all.
Supposedly it was
some sort of generational ship had left Earth at some point, like, around 20 years ago from today, which today being, you know, November 2011, and just, like, went off into the galaxy, never to be heard from again, and then they ended up there.
That's a long way for a generational ship to go in 400 years.
It is a long way. And then just set up shop there.
Yeah, and apparently they had enough time to, like, found a civilization.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the time moves differently in this galaxy.
Oh, dear.
Yes, it's a lot faster there or something like that.
Huh.
Is what it is. I think, anyway. I think it was faster there. And then that's why they've got this, like, sprawling empire that's been there for, like, 10,000 of their years or some such. And,
oh, dear.
Yeah, like, you can tell that they're trying to say Earth, but they call it Arth. It's spelled A-U-R-T-H.
It reminded me of Demolition Man. What's your boggle?
What's your boggle? That's right. I was thinking more like Firefly, actually. Huh. You know, go ram it, things like that.
Well, yeah, but those are just new swear words. In Firefly, they still know what all the old words that they use are. They know what Earth was.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they call it Earth that was.
Exactly, that's right. Okay. Anyway, so they get there, and they're trying to find this way back and such, and then they find out that their arrival has disrupted the cloud in some way. And the inhabitants that be of this part of space here are all like, oh my gosh, you guys have fiddled with the Great Sleeping One, which is supposed to be this, like, big mass of consciousness that's this, you know, celestial phenomenon that's hanging out there.
Who let Lovecraft into my Star Trek?
If it ever wakes up, it's going to obliterate all life, is what it's going to do. So the Romulan fleet, the Titan, and this Klingon ship all end up here through this rift. This rift has transported them here. You know, via caretaker logic from Voyager, you know. Not that it brought them here, it was by accident, you know.
Yeah, stuff. I got like, that. It's spatial rifts do that sort of stuff all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So they end up there, and their coming there has disrupted the sleeping patterns and whatnot, is what's happened here.
Hmm.
Now, everyone else is just like, oh, superstition, whatever, don't care about it. But then there's actual science saying, no, guys, this thing's going to blow up and destroy all life.
So is it actually a consciousness, or is it just some kind of anomaly?
It's never made clear.
Huh. Fascinating.
Because the way it's written makes it seem like that perhaps it does have a consciousness of some sort, but there's never anything explicitly saying, yeah, this thing is alive and has a will of its own.
How much does it look like a squid, is my question.
It's never described visually. It's only referred to as the sleeper or the eye cloud thingamajig.
Oh my.
Yeah. So, you know. I mean, there's pretty color descriptions, but we're never told whether it's like looks like a star, if it looks like a nebula, anything like that. It's just the Great Sleeping One.
Fill in the blanks.
Yeah. So, now what they have to do is they have to try to find a way to stop it, or they have to evacuate everybody. Now, I had made mention of this at one point earlier. The plan they come up with is they decide to take this hollowed-out asteroid that is used for, like, museum purposes or something like that, right? And they evacuate all the inhabitants of the planet, as many as they can shove, into this rock.
That must be a big-ass rock.
And tow it out of this area of space back into our own galaxy.
I thought they had a sprawling empire.
They did. They only had the one planet, though.
Sprawling empire.
Well, they...
Oh. Okay, so
they had the one rock around the one planet.
So they just left everyone else to die.
They did.
Oh, I hope they feel good about that.
Well, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do, I suppose. So, and then they gotta get back by using the fleet of warbirds that they had, you know, there, which have no one's on them now. All the people are gone.
Wait, what?
Which is never explained. All the people are just gone. And they use, like, the combined power from all, like, the quantum singularity reactors to get themselves a portal back to our space.
Okay, well, free warbirds, I guess.
Well, the warbirds are destroyed because they have to stay there to open the thing up.
What? Oh, lame.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Whose fleet was that? Was that Seth's?
That was the Notra's fleet.
I bet she must be pleased.
Not so much, bro.
She must be excited about this.
Not so much. All right, and that's how that one ends. Mm-hmm. They get back to space and everything's cool, and then they get this asteroid full of refugees.
So they showed up and accidentally doomed an entire civilization?
Yes.
Good. Strong work, Titan.
I know, their mission
Captain Riker's first mission is good. Is good. Destroy entire extra human civilization.
In a matter of week, too.
Uh-huh.
Just a matter of a week. Alright, so then we got on to Orion's Hounds after Titan limbs back to space dock and gets itself repaired. Now it's actually on its mission of exploration, which is what the ship was designed to do in the first place.
If I was Starfleet Command and I read Riker's mission statement, I would never let him go outside ever again. Because apparently the first thing he did was blow up a civilization.
It's only been escalating from there, mind you. Well,
how do you escalate
TNG, from TNG, was what I meant. It's only been escalating up. Because every time he's in command or some such, shit goes down in some way, and it's never favorable. You know, like, the height of things I always felt was... in Generations.
Oh, goodness.
Right? He's in command and the ship blows up.
Yeah. I mean, people like to talk about Troy crashing the ship, but honestly, that was Riker's fault. I mean, because Riker is like, instead of just ordering...
We saw the Enterprise fire twice.
Yep. Instead of ordering just fire all weapons and blow up that Klingon bird of prey, which is like the size of a large shuttlecraft by some estimations, that he was like, let's get out of here. Let's slowly turn. Fire one torpedo. Whereas with Troy, it was like, okay, Like, she, I mean, all she was doing was accelerating. It wasn't like she could have done any fancy flying to avoid the shockwave.
Yeah.
It was like, maybe we can dodge the explosion.
Get out of the way. All right, so the next one we have is called Orion's Hounds. This is actually my personal favorite novel out of the series.
Is that just because you like dogs?
Well, I do like dogs.
Are there any dogs in this story?
No.
Why is it called Orion's Hounds?
I'm getting to that.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, Titan's heading off to the Orion constellation is what it is. And out that way, they happen across some sandbars, quote-unquote. Or okay. Coral reefs in space, if you will. They're not a physical formation of a coral reef, mind you, but the metaphor of that being that all these, like, star clusters
it's
and
stellar... It's a thing that your ship can hit that makes it stop.
Also not correct in this case.
No?
But, no. Well, no, because the sandbar, I mean, yes, your ship will stop if it hits it. But more or less, when you come across a sandbar, you will find there's, like, stuff on it. Like, stuff that's alive.
Huh.
Not necessarily, like, big, large, like, stuff. Mind you, like, big fish or anything like that. But, like, small, like, you know, crabs or, like, little tiny fish or plankton. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find hanging around. And they find out that this area of space has a lot of what's called cosmozoan life forms. Which you remember encountered from Farpoint?
Oh, the space jellyfish?
Yeah, that's a cosmozoan.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
Okay.
That's how they're termed anyway, is cosmozoan, which they're big space-faring...
Is cosmozoan a real term, or did they make that up?
I don't actually know if it is or not.
Huh. That's something I want to look up. But anyway, keep going.
It sounds like it might be a real term.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of real.
It sounds very real. So, anyway, they're hanging around space, and they find these big jellyfish, which are exactly the ones they found at Farpoint.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, they're like, oh, man, the jellyfish things, woo! And then Riker and Troy get all nostalgic about it and start waxing about days of old. Then suddenly these other ships come out of nowhere and start shooting at it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah! And, like, kill it and take it a prize.
I remember those jellyfish being pretty badass. Are these other ships just, like, you know, armed for bear, or is it... Because, like, if you remember, the big jellyfish that showed up to rescue the jellyfish on the planet could have, like, eaten the Enterprise for breakfast.
Could it have? Because I don't... Yeah. Because they never fought.
No, they didn't, because Picard was like, I don't want to fight that thing. But it was like shooting down, like, huge torrents of energy and, like...
And blowing up mud huts.
Troy was talking about it like it was going to wreck their shit, let me tell you.
No, I don't think it could have stood up to the Enterprise if they really wanted to get into a fight with it. But anyway... and they find out that the ships, they come and hunt, and these ships are actually the jellyfish creatures themselves that are piloted by another alien race, which are described as avian, kind of vulture-looking dudes.
So they've, like, hollowed out the, they've hollowed out the space jellyfish and are flying them around?
They are flying them around in a traditional hunt-type scenario, kind of like Indian whaling.
Huh.
Yeah,
I don't remember any Native American tribes like canoeing around in the hollowed out husk of a whale. Although I'm going to suggest that to them next time I eat.
So the only way you can hunt whales is by using another whale as your ship.
I'm going to go head up to the like tribal conference and be like, "All right, guys, I know that whaling is a part of your tradition and that it's important and you know a big part of your culture, but I think." That what you should do is kill a whale and then ride around in it.
By the way. So, anyway, you know, like, the crew of the Titan sees this, and they're like, no, and shakes their finger at them, and this is like, hey, you should stop doing this, alien race. And they're just like, no, this is like, totally our lives, dude.
No, this is what we do.
Yeah.
We make a big profit off of whale bacon.
So then Riker and the Titan go off to try to communicate with these, you know, jellyfish creatures. And be like, all right, these guys are hunting you. We want to help you guys defend yourselves. And they do. They actually help the jellyfish be able to defend themselves. Now, the twist comes later,
okay.
Mind you.
What's the twist?
All right, so now the jellyfish start hunting the hunters.
Well, who would have thought, right?
So
I say the hunters got what they deserved.
Right, so the hunters go back to Titan, and Titan's all like, hey, what's up, bro? And the hunters are like, you know what? This was like how we were sustaining our civilization and culture. There was a cycle and a balance that was going on here. Now the balance is all out of whack, thanks to you guys.
Goodness. You know, I can't... I hate
it. Let me draw a better analogy. This was like the American Indians and the buffalo.
Yeah, but the buffalo... The whole, like, balance cycle thing doesn't work if the thing you're hunting to survive is sentient. That's just a murder cycle is what that is. You need to stop that. You can't justify killing someone else by saying, I needed to do it to survive. Because, that you know, that's, like... Regardless of how you feel about eating meat, whether you're a vegetarian or not... it's a pretty big leap to go from circle of life hunting thing to I'm gonna go murder a bunch of other sentient life forms to feed my civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So those guys, they can deal with it. I don't have any sympathy for them.
Well, they end up having to deal with it more or less because they try to reach a compromise between the jellyfish and the what were they called?
The Hirogen?
Not the Hirogen.
They sound
they
kind may, of
like they
the
may
Hirogen.
As well be the Hirogen, though. No, they're not as sadistic as the Hirogen are, though. But they try to strike a deal of some sort between them so that the jellyfish can live, but the alien race can also inhabit them at the same time and use them still for their, you know...
Ew.
Yes.
Like having... Next up, we're having a conference between humans and tapeworms.
So, and it doesn't quite work out as well, but it's a compromise, and, you know, no one... The definition of compromise is the deal no one's happy with.
I feel like the jellyfish are getting screwed by this deal. I don't think this other civilization has much of a leg to stand on.
Well, it's been a thing with them, it's that it's been tradition for so long that it's just become the way of life, and they can't survive without doing this, is what it's become. Well, now, it sucks that that's the way it is, but, I mean, what are you going to do as Captain Riker the Titan? Are you just going to let him die and let the jellyfish stomp on them?
I mean, if they're so stubborn that the only way they're willing to live is by subjugating other races, then yeah, let them die. It's at this point, it's not your fault that they're getting...
Captain Riker doesn't let that happen, though, in this novel.
I mean, it's... Yeah, I mean, what he's doing is what he's done here is he's forced another race to continue to live in servitude, granted only partial servitude, but still servitude because the first race refuses to change. They're like, no, we're not going to stop, and we deserve to live anyway.
I should let you read the novel. I think you can get it.
God, no. Anyway. All right.
Then there's Sword of Damocles, which is the next one here, which is their next little bit of adventure.
Sword of Damocles, that sounds like some kind of metaphor that maybe I've heard of before.
Nah, bro, it's cool.
Okay, all right.
And they come across a world where there's this eye up in the sky that they can't explain scientifically at all in any way. Now, mind you, this is a little more advanced civilization. It's not like, you know, some sort of, like, medieval society or society like ours today. It's be ahead of ours,
it's
probably about 100 years. I'm sorry?
It's not Mud Hut Bill?
It is not Mud Hut Bill. It's not, they're not praising Snake God or anything like that for their civic projects.
Snake God!
For their, you know, dumb civic projects or anything like that. They can't explain it.
That's a joke from the video game From Dust, because that was like an in-joke we just made, which is kind of a no-no on podcasting. But anyway, that if you want to know what Snake God is, just go play From Dust. It's a pretty fun game. Anyway.
So, they can't figure out if this eye is a natural phenomena or if it actually has consciousness behind it, you know?
Okay.
Now, go back, see Red King for pretty much the rest of the plot for this one.
Okay. How?
Because them showing up is, in fact, a catalyst for the thing becoming malevolent and then starting to wipe stuff out.
Didn't they already do this story with Voyager? It was called Wink of an Eye?
Was Wink of an Eye... Wink of an Eye is the name of a TOS episode.
No, sorry, Blink of an Eye is the Voyager episode, which was actually not a tribute to the TOS episode. It was originally going to be called Wink of an Eye, and then they realized there was already a TNG, a TOS episode called that, and so they changed it. and it's like the premise of the plot of Blink of an Eye, the Voyager episode, is that, like, Voyager is hanging out. I guess it's not the same, because Voyager is hanging out in orbit of this planet that, like, rotates super fast, so time is passing super fast, and, like, so this entire civilization, like, evolves and, like, advances seeing Voyager up in the sky, and, like, that's the one where, like, the Doctor gets stuck down there for, like, 20 years, and he, like, gets a family somehow, and then they just tear him away from it, because for them it was only a few minutes. And then, like, the civilization eventually gets advanced enough that they decide they're going to shoot Voyager down, because, like, Voyager being in orbit apparently causes earthquakes or something.
So this thing has been in the sky for, like, hundreds of years, and they just decide to shoot it down as soon as they have missiles?
First they tried sending a space expedition to it, and, like, the space expedition got to Voyager and then never came back, because, like, one of the astronauts died, and the other one was, like, somehow adjusted to Voyager's slower time scale. So, like, down on the planet, like, another 100 years passed, and they, like, never heard from their space institute, like, they never heard from their, you know, from their space expedition. And they may have sent others that just never made it, we don't know. Uh-huh. But apparently Voyager was causing, like, seismic problems. And so they were eventually, and they couldn't hail it because of the time difference, which they probably didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just like, alright, whatever, we're gonna bulldoze this thing.
This big thing in the sky we don't understand that's causing problems. Like, we're going to blow it up.
The story of Blink of an Eye was actually pretty much copied from the novel Dragon's Egg, which is basically the same story, except the aliens are way more alien-looking.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that was what I first thought when I read the premise for Sword of Damocles. But I guess the Titan isn't the thing that's floating in the sky. It just shows up and makes the floating sky thing mad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
As usual. Riker comes along and makes things mad.
Do they shoot it with phasers?
No.
They should.
They just shoot this thing. There seems to be a recurring motif with you about blowing shit up.
I'm just saying.
That you don't understand.
If there's a thing that wants to blow up a planet and you can't reason with it, you gotta shoot it with phasers. What else are you gonna do?
See Star Trek Online for that entry. All right, so, and Sword of Damocles, I didn't, that's actually my second favorite, or second least favorite novel.
Uh-huh.
The one I hate the most is actually the next one, which is Over a Torrent Sea.
Wait, I'm not done talking about Sword of Damocles.
Oh, you're not, okay.
How do they resolve this situation? Does the evil eye just eat the planet? You're nodding to me.
I am not.
Is that what happened? Oh my god. no one ever let Riker out of space dock. He's just...
No, it's cool, bro. This is exploration.
Do they try to stop it?
They try. But it doesn't work.
Do they shoot it with torpedoes?
No. Torpedoes don't work.
So, like, Riker just leaves?
Well, they try to evacuate people, but it doesn't work, so...
God, this is a fail ship full of fail people. My goodness.
Alright, so, Over a Torrent Sea is the next one. This one I dislike the most. Titan comes across the planet that's all water, but uh-huh. still has a bunch of life on it.
Uh-huh.
They're like, whoa, this is cool! So they start checking it out and such... And as they're checking it out, they're making their planetary survey and whatnot, they notice that there's this huge asteroid coming towards the planet.
Ooh.
And they figure, oh man, this is totally going to destroy and disrupt everything on the planet. We have to stop it. So they go do that, they fly off, and they destroy the asteroid and whatnot. Now, in the meantime, there's a survey crew
They'll
left on...
They'll shoot the asteroid with phasers. So, man.
They do shoot the asteroid with phasers and whatnot and blow it up into a bunch of different little pieces. So anyway, they go back to the planet, and they find out that one of their survey crews has gone missing.
Uh-huh.
Is what happens after a bunch of meteor impacts happen and whatnot.
Wait, so they blew it up instead of using their tractor beam to push it out of the way?
Yes.
Oh, goodness. You know, Kirk had this shit figured out, like, way back in the day. Granted, that was a really stupid episode where Kirk became an Indian, and, like, you know, it was basically just...
Well, they didn't have an obelisk on hand here in this episode.
But they didn't, need the obelisk in that episode, because they were going to push it out of the way with the tractor beam, and they...
I thought the obelisk blew it up.
It may have, but that was only because, like, something unforeseen went wrong. Like, the Enterprise was perfectly capable of deflecting the asteroid on its own. But then something happened, I forget what.
Okay, alright. Anyway, what happens next is that the, survey crew runs into some sentient whales.
Yeah, okay.
Sentient whales hanging out, and the whales don't want them there at all.
Like, I can't imagine why not.
Yep, so the whales decide to leave... crewman Leia, and then Riker on this little island thingamajig.
Okay.
For, like, a while until they can figure out what they're trying to do so they can confirm their claims that an asteroid is coming down and it's going to ruin their ship.
Do they have the technology to confirm that?
Apparently they do.
Huh.
Yeah, apparently they're able to, like, look into space and stuff. And whatnot. How exactly is never explained. They just can. They just do. And whatnot. And they actually end up growing a spaceship later on in the book.
Fascinating.
Yep, out of water stuff.
Is it a bigger whale in space?
No, it's like a little water pod thing.
Huh.
I mean, it'd be some... The way they were describing it in the book is it'd be similar to a, like, one of our first, like, Saturn V rockets.
Alright.
Similar to that. How exactly is it going to get into space, I don't know, because I don't know what kind of volatile chemicals you can make in the water.
I don't know. All kinds of stuff.
I'm not a scientist or a chemist, so, you know. I'm just a simple podcaster doing a Star Trek podcast.
Okay, so anyway, what happens after that?
So, after that, they leave, you know, Riker and Leia, they're on the island, and then Titan's trying to find them and whatever. They can't find him anywhere, because their sensors are dumb, for whatever reason. They can't penetrate the thingamajig with the atmosphere because of the stupid asteroid that's going on right there. And later they find out the asteroid is actually supposed to hit the planet.
Oh, God.
Because the reason being, and this is actually illustrated really clearly with the way we see Riker handling his lack of mineral intake. There's not a whole lot of mineral element to be found in a whole lot of places. We as humans kind of need a mineral intake along with, you know, our daily diet in order to be what we are. You know, because calcium's a good thing. And we can see Riker, like, starting to, like, you know, wither away and such over the course of a few weeks in this book as a result of his lack of mineral intake. And the rest of the life on the planet is sustained also with some mineral intake. And that's what the asteroid impacts are for. These asteroids slamming into the planet are delivering the minerals that the rest of the inhabitants of the planet need in order to survive by infusing the water with a bunch of this mineral.
But, so it doesn't wipe out all life every time it hits?
No, it doesn't.
Oh my goodness.
Again, good job, Titan.
USS Titan, destroyer of worlds! Oh my goodness, I can't deal with this. I mean, I always thought Riker deserved his own command, but I take everything back. I take it all back. Riker has no place in that chair, apparently.
Yeah, so, but eventually they're able to find a diplomatic option, and they get, you know, Riker and the crewman Alea back onto the ship, and everyone leaves happy.
Do they get everyone their minerals back?
No, but...
Did they fix the problem?
The problem was fixed. They eventually, like, tracked it to, like, some rocks in or something, I think is what they did.
Okay, so at least they actually fixed this one.
I mean, it would be akin to, like, if food stores were kind of tight for, like, a couple months.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't, like, a huge crisis that this asteroid didn't hit. Like, the pieces of it still came down, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not as much as they would have liked to have, you know, but... It's not like, oh, life was going to die.
All right.
You know, it's just kind of like, oh, man, you've messed with, like, the cycle. Why have you messed with the cycle? Stop messing with the cycle.
All right. Well, at least they fixed the problem they caused this time.
Yeah. Did you have any questions about over Torrent Sea at all before we move on to synthesis?
So, like, the aliens on there were not, they were not humanoid. They were whaloid.
They were whaloid.
I forget what, there's actually a scientific term for that, but I forget what it is.
Well, yeah, they were predominantly, like, bigger kind of, like, you know, oh, man. Porpoises, I guess would be the word.
Porpoise? Dolphins?
Not dolphins. Well, whales. I don't remember the word.
Did they have anything to do with the probe from Star Trek IV?
Oh, man. They did. That would be rad.
That was kind of what I was first thinking when I read the synopsis.
Oh, my goodness. I hope they did, but they don't. The book never says they do or anything like that.
Okay. So, like, do they have opposable thumbs?
Not that it was ever described.
Huh. Fascinating. All right. So most of it is there like a romance going on between Riker and the lady crewman?
Oh my god. Not right now there isn't.
Oh.
They were involved at one point cuz she's a Pacifican.
Are they aquatic?
Yes. Okay. Well, they're sort of aquatic. They become amphibious later in life, I think is what happens.
Oh.
But apparently the story is the whole quote-unquote romance that was between them was more or less Riker came to the planet. She was really hot and heavy to go, like, in her early life or whatever it is. Apparently all Pacificans are really hot and heavy in their early life.
Uh-huh.
And they want to get it on with everyone and everything.
Uh-huh.
For whatever reason. And she got on with Riker at one point, and that was the extent of their romance, I think.
Was this before or after he was married with Troy?
This is way before.
Okay.
This is when he was, you know, like, early Starfleet career before we saw Next Generation.
I guess I can't add adultery to the lists of Riker's sins.
It's all in one go. You've destroyed a planet, disrupted the cycle of the planet, and you've committed adultery. Good job, Riker.
You also destroyed a mini-galaxy. I think that's pretty high up on the list. I think of all the Star Trek captains, Riker might apparently have the highest body count.
My goodness. Alright.
Which is, you know, I didn't think it was possible after Archer decided to let an entire civilization die out, but...
Which one was that?
Remember, that was Dear Doctor.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Space Canada. That's right. So, yeah, that was kind of the extent of their romance, and then it was more or less... This is why I really don't like this character, is that it was a lot of soul-searching for her, which is really something that should have gone on for her the previous 40 years of her life already, of her...
Wait,
looking
how
at Riker.
Old is she?
I think she's, like, in her 70s or so at this point.
And she's still a crewman?
She's an ensign at this point.
She's still an ensign.
She's an ensign.
70 years old.
Well, I mean, I don't know how long Pacificans live and whatnot, but...
How long has she been in Starfleet?
Presumably for, you know, these 5 years, the four as a cadet and then an ensign.
Oh, okay. All right, so she was fairly old when she was, like, in her 60s when she went into Starfleet then.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I mean, just the life cycle of these Pacificans, you know, is...
It's all
just
wonky.
...is different than what, you know, would be normal for us as humans. But anyway, the whole like, sequence of her taking care of Riker... Because Riker can barely take care of himself because he doesn't have proper nutrition at this point. He's withering away because he doesn't have any mineral intake.
Uh-huh.
So goes the story. It has her, like, thinking about, like, her life, and, oh my gosh, I've been so terrible in the past, and oh my goodness.
Has she been terrible in the past?
She was. She was so terrible. My goodness. She was the worst mother ever.
She was a mom.
She was a mom, yes.
Okay.
Because she was being so promiscuous, she had a bunch of children, then promptly left the children in the care of her sister so she can go on being more promiscuous.
And that's not normal for her species. Because I...
Well, no, that is normal for her species.
Why is it bad, then? Isn't that just what her sister's species does?
No, it's normal for them to be promiscuous, but not to the point to where they disregard all responsibility.
So they're supposed to be promiscuous with protection, then? I'm just trying to figure out these specificans, okay? These specificans are weirding me out.
I mean, she's supposed to be a more extreme case, is okay. What it is. To where she would throw off all responsibility so she can go be wild and crazy in her younger years.
Okay.
Is what it is. And she can continue to be so until she got the sense of responsibility to, you know...
Are you sure she's not an Evergreen student?
She could very well be an Evergreen student. And it's, for those that don't know, Evergreen State University, is that right?
Yeah, that's where I graduated.
Yeah. That's a college here in the state of Washington.
It has a bit of a reputation.
The hippie college.
Anyway, keep going.
So yeah, that whole kind of scenario in just felt really out of place given how the character was described being so old and having this other sense of responsibility that she felt years ago to pick up already.
Yeah.
It just felt so weird to have that sequence in there. It felt really unnecessary to have that in there.
Maybe she reached the stage in her life when she gets to reflect on all the bad things. I mean, it sounds like...
Midlife crisis.
Yeah, it sounds like these Pacificans have a very regimental life cycle. So maybe once they hit a certain age, that's the age of reflection.
Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't like the sequence all that much.
It doesn't sound like a very good story.
It wasn't a very good story. That's why it's my least favorite novel.
Which is sad, because I'm actually really interested in stories about aquatic sentient races, but it sounds like most of it wasn't spent with the aquatic guys.
It was.
It sounds like most of it was spent on an island.
It was. Well, not most of it was spent on an island. Most of it was spent, like, looking at the planet and then discovering the asteroid was coming and then blowing up the asteroid.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and the last, like... fifth of the book was, like, the island part of it, and then diplomatizing with the whales. Alright, so, now, Synthesis.
Yeah?
Which is the latest one.
That's the one that has Riker's, like, old holodeck flame on the cover.
Yes.
What's up with that?
Alright, so, the ship's flying through space, and they come across this, like, derelict...
Wait, hold it. For reference, to anyone who doesn't know who I'm talking about...
Minuet.
Minuet was her name, and it was in, I don't remember the name of the episode, but it was in the first season.
11001001.
Oh, seriously?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Where the ship was getting a big
with
refit.
The Binars.
The ship was getting a big refit by these guys called the Binars, who were all, like, linked together through some kind of hive mind, kind of like the Proto-Borg. And one of the things they upgraded was the holodeck, and I think that may have been the first episode where they really used the holodeck to simulate people. I think before that, it might just have been for, like, environments and stuff.
The Big Goodbye was before that, I think. Oh.
Okay, well, never mind. I don't know what kind of upgrades they were talking about then, because they claimed to have upgraded the holodeck.
I think it might have been, like, they were trying to cover it up with character personality,
yeah,
like, improvements is what it was.
All they did was invent a woman who knew how to tell Riker exactly what he wanted to hear, which
yep.
wasn't really that hard. I mean, Riker's not exactly a complex individual. But anyway, they did that, and so he had this, like, almost a romance with this hologram, but, like, then that all got interrupted when the ship got stolen, and that never really went anywhere.
Yep.
And it came up again in The Ruse, I think, is the episode where...
Yes, yeah, The Ruse is the one
where
he gets gassed.
That's the one where Riker is trapped in, like...
It's like a pseudo-holodeck type thing.
Yeah, it's like a simulation that, like, with this alien kid, and the simulation tries to give him everything he wants, and, like, so... When he's, like, in the simulation, he's, like, 15 years older, and it shows, like, images of his dead wife, and it's, like, the hollow lady, and that's what cues him in that something's wrong.
Wait a minute, that's the holographic lady. What's going on here?
Okay, so why is she on the cover of this book?
All right, so the reason she's on the book is because she's a representative of the ship's AI, and that's the graphical representation of it that we see.
The Titan's AI?
The Titan's AI.
Who chose that representation?
Well, the ship did.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and the reason being is because the ship's AI was uplifted by another AI.
Oh my.
Yeah, so what happens is the Titan's flying through space, and they come across this derelict spacecraft thingamajig, where they find a, you know, a personality core from, like, Portal, more or less.
Yeah. Do they throw it in the incinerator?
No, you don't throw it in the incinerator. No, they bring it on board and they...
No, you don't do that. You put them in the incinerator. I've seen this. I've done this before. I did this a lot, okay? You take it and you knock it off glass with a rocket and you put it in the incinerator.
Yeah, anyway, so they bring it on board, they fix it up, and They're like, oh man, this thing is like sentient stuff. And this thing is called Blue White? Something like that? It has some weird, like...
Blue White, huh?
It's got some sort of color name designation thing that's going on. But anyway, he's a part of an AI, or the civilization of AI, is what it is, that was created a long, long time ago to fight the null space.
That sounds like a hard thing to fight.
The null space. Well, what's going on here in this region of space is there's these things from null space coming out trying to invade our space. Now, why... don't really know.
Why? I don't know.
Don't really know why they're coming in here trying to invade our space and whatnot. But
all kinds of things always try to invade our space.
This AI civilization has been given the directive of fighting and defeating this null space, you know, problem is what it is.
Okay.
Excuse me. So, now, along with this civilization, they feel that any AI they come across that isn't at the level they are needs to be freed or uplifted. And that's what happens with the Titans AI, or the Titans computer.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so this Blue White, well, I'm just going to keep calling him Blue White, because I think that's his its name, excuse me. I'm just going to call him he, because everyone refers to it as a he. Uplifts the Titans AI, and the Titans AI is then represented by Minuet.
Oh, bye.
That's why Minuet's on the cover.
why does the Titan have Minuet on file? Did Riker bring her over from the Enterprise?
Yeah.
That's kind of disturbing. Mm. What was Riker doing with her? Riker's a married man. I'm not going to be down on anyone who wants to use the holodeck for porn. I don't have a problem with that, but,
Maybe Troy's in on it, a little menage a trois with Minuet.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, man.
I'm just saying, if that's what they're into, I'm not going to judge. That's entirely their thing. Really, it's funny. Their marriage.
I can imagine if Troy didn't know about this, and, like, suddenly this appeared, and Troy was like, Riker, who's that? What's going on? That'd be really embarrassing for Riker.
Actually, if I recall correctly, there is kind of a scene like that.
Oh, dear.
If I remember right. But anyway, it goes on, and Riker wants to help out the AI civilization defeat null space, because the implication is that if the AI lose, which they're probably going to, since they're all falling in disrepair and they can't really repair themselves or make more of themselves at a rate to which they can replenish their, like, military ranks.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is null space is going to, like, start taking over the entirety of the galaxy.
Okay, so where's that armada that he piloted into Romulan space?
That's all hanging out in that, cloud still.
We need the armada. Where's the armada?
Just can't have it, bro. Just can't have it.
This is a situation we need an armada for.
More or less. So, anyway, they find out later that they're trying to, you know, like, get in touch with, like, the upper echelons of this AI civilization race, because they actually have a hierarchy in place where they have, like, command units and other units that are in charge of, like, the civilization and resource management dudes. And there's this, like, whole actual, like, structure to their society instead of being, like, the Borg, where it's, like, the queen and then the collective. It's more like an actually functioning society is what it is with this race of AI.
Okay. And so what do the Geth do next?
All right. So the Geth, now at this point, what they're doing is they decide that they don't need Riker's help. And promptly start shooting at him.
Well, they probably read his service record from the Titan, and they know what happens when Riker shows up.
The reason they don't want his help is because Blue Whitehead made contact with them and starts sharing information with them, which is a big no-no in AI society, for whatever reason.
Huh.
Sharing this information.
Sharing information is computers don't like. That's kind of weird. It'd be like having a society of sentient trees and having a photosynthesis being against the rules. It's kind of what they do. It's kind of their thing.
Well, anything that's not them, the AI.
Okay.
Is what it is. So, but they end up being able to give the AI help, the help they need in order to defeat the null space through crazy computer.
Oh, dear.
Oh, man. So there's this, there's these big, planetoid-sized computer AIs.
Are there?
That are, like, they're called the first gens, or zero gen, maybe, is what they're called. But they're, like, the first ones of their kind.
Uh-huh.
Is what they were when they first were created, you know, years and years ago. And there was one of them that went crazy or insane, so everyone was saying, right?
Yeah.
Apparently he had figured out a way to, like, defeat null space, so they managed to bring him back, and they figure out how to get rid of null space, which has to do with sciencey-wyancey stuff.
Sciencey-wyancey, timey-wimey.
Wibbly-wobbly, you know. And then they magic really hard at the null, and they manage to get rid of him, and then Titan goes on their way.
Okay, so they managed not to blow up a civilization this time. Good
they,
job, Riker.
They don't. They don't. It's true. That's the last novel we've had so far. But apparently, as you're saying, there's another one coming out. So we'll see what happens to Riker's track record in the next novel, if there's another novel coming out. So, anything you want to touch on?
Well, I mean, first of all, what? These stories...
About the Titan series?
Yeah, I mean, these stories just make Riker out to be a bit of a tool. I mean, like, I like making fun of Riker, but honestly, I never found him to be incompetent. Mm-hmm. But he just sounds really bad at his job from listening to these stories.
Well, I have the books. I can give them to you, read, and you can judge it for yourself. The things I like about Titan the most are, mm-hmm. one, it's tied in right from the end of Nemesis.
I'm not sure that's a bonus, but whatever.
Well, I like it because there's this thread, obviously, off of Nemesis, and what the Titan series has done is pulled that thread, mm-hmm. and is now running with it.
And right. Unraveling all of Star Trek's sweatshirt.
More or less. It's starting us off with familiar characters.
Yeah.
You know, people we know, and some of them we love and hate, you know, probably hate more than others.
That's actually one thing I was wondering. How is it in terms of, like, portraying those characters? I mean, with Troy, I mean, obviously, Troy doesn't have much of a character by the end of Star Trek.
Troy really acts more as, or tries to act more like a sage counselor for, huh. like, Riker.
Interesting.
Because she doesn't do, like, a whole lot else on the ship, no, like TNG.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
You know, she's a chief diplomatic officer and then the counselor, which even then, when they meet all these races and stuff, it's not her who's leading the charge on, like, talking to them and stuff. It's typically, like, his first officer or someone else.
That's kind
of
funny.
It's never Troy.
Well, it's good to know that they've kept up the TNG dynamic of having other people do Troy's job.
Yeah. Tuvok, he's as Vulcan stoic as ever, as we saw him in Voyager, which I happen to like the Tuvok character.
Yeah, I mean, of all the Voyager characters, he's probably one of the better ones, because he's not stupid and incompetent, but he's also not really, like, too awesome at his job like Paris.
Yeah, you know, Tuvok, he's pretty much the Vulcan we've always known and loved. Then Ogawa, which, I mean, we didn't see a whole lot of her.
Yeah, was Ogawa in the Lower Decks?
Lower Decks,
yeah.
Yes, she was one of the four people we saw.
Yeah, and she was cool in that, but we didn't, like, get a too firm handle on her character.
Yeah, which, I mean, she seems to spend a lot of time just kind of, you know, being in sick bay or spending time with her son or so, which her son's name is Noah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, which she seems like, you know, a character that I can like just because, you know, she seems very real. You know, she's not involved in any, like, the bigger decisions on the ship or anything like that. She's just functioning on it like she did in Lower Decks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's an alright character. One of my favorite characters is actually the chief medical officer. He's a Pakwathon.
A what?
A Pakwathon.
A Pakwathon. A Pakwathon.
And it is literally looks like a dinosaur.
Oh.
Not Gorn dinosaur, not mind Gorn, you, no. But more like, as Riker describes it, a velociraptor.
Oh. Well, at least he's not a duckbill. Seriously, guys, don't ever let your kid play with a duckbill. Duckbills are the most loser dinosaur. If your favorite dinosaur is duckbill, get help.
Yeah, but he's actually one of the weaker members of his species.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah, but he's still, like, fierce, and he's got really long claws and stuff, and he has some of the best lines, I swear, of the series.
Does anyone ever say clever girl to him?
Not that I remember or recall, but I will reread them to find out.
No one's going to make a Jurassic Park reference on him?
Yeah. I really like these secondary arcs for the characters, or like the B-plots that are presented, because they carry over the novels, is what they do.
Uh-huh.
And one of them, which... I'm going to open this up by saying that I'm not against people who are gay at all.
Yeah, okay.
Anything like that. I don't have a problem with gay people at all. Anything like that. Typically, in most fiction that I read, where there are gay characters involved, it feels very much like they were shoehorned in, or they're not being done properly, or they're not... or there's too much time being spent on their, you know, sexual orientation.
Sometimes that's true.
For most of the fiction I've read. Now, it's actually done really, really well with one of the science officers, I think it's a science officer, in Titan, to where, yes, we know they're gay, and that they have this inclination towards Keru, who's the chief tactical officer, but it's not done in a way to where it's in your face, and they're trying to make it seem like that this issue that they have of being gay is, like, a problem or anything like that at all, and that it needs to be accepted in society, because it more or less kind of already is, I think, in Star Trek anyway, that gay people are a thing.
So what it is it's a gay character as opposed to the story, like, being all excited and being like, hey guys, there's a gay person in this story. They're just one of the characters is just gay.
Right.
Okay. I mean, like, and that's cool, and I actually think that we need more of that. I feel like that would be a good direction for our storytelling to go in.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like they're more just, like, a functional person in the story as opposed to having to bring up that they're not defined
by their sexuality.
Exactly.
Right.
Which was fantastic. But it's this ongoing thing where they don't feel like they can be accepted for it still.
Hmm.
But you can still interchange that element for anything else, whether it be, you know, I have no left eye, for instance, or something like that. You know, it's like you can interchange that kind of thing with any other problem, which I think makes for good storytelling, is that this character does have they feel something that won't let them fit in with the rest of whatever group they're interfacing with, which is portrayed really, really well with this character being gay.
Fair enough.
You know, they're not sure how to approach this other person because they have feelings for them and such, and it's an arc that carries through the novels.
So, out of curiosity, is this a man or a woman?
Man.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure because I thought I heard you say the tactical officer's name and it sounded female.
Keru. He's a
Keru. Okay.
Keru.
Okay. For some reason, I thought you said Kira, and I was like, I know it's not from Deep Space Nine. I thought maybe it was another Bajoran. But anyway, all right.
The gay character is Bajoran, though.
Oh, fascinating.
If I remember right.
Huh. There's a whole religious subtext thing going on there.
Well, I don't know what the prophet's stances are on...
Well, considering that every other time this has ever come up, the prophets have basically been Catholic.
Really? You think so?
Yeah, that's... not the prophets themselves, but the Bajoran religious... The Bajoran spiritual religion is basically space Catholicism in most ways that matter. I mean... When it comes up, obviously there are a lot of Catholic things that the Bajorans don't do because they don't go into a lot of detail. But in the episodes where Bajoran spiritual beliefs have come into conflict with the Federation values, they've always been portrayed as kind of being Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to cast aspersions on Catholicism by any means. I'm just highlighting the parallels.
Right. Okay. Yeah, but I feel there's a lot of good secondary arcs for the characters that are done really well, and done in a way that's not intrusive to the main stories. Mm-hmm. Like, the main story can continue on, you can get your full enjoyment out of the main story without the secondary story having to, you know, take a baseball bat to it.
I'm not sure if enjoyment is the word I would choose to take from the main story.
And then it just, the whole series just kind of carries on with that idea of being able to just explore space. And having those stories,
cool.
Of exploring space and whatnot, no matter how destructive we are to that space when we get there. some of the things I don't like about Titan, one, I wish there was more of it, which it sounds like there's more coming.
There are like three other books that are technically qualified as Titan books, but you don't like them because they're crossovers.
Well, that's actually my second point for why I don't like Titan, or one of the reasons I don't like Titan is because there's this series of novels called Star Trek Destiny, and it's a trilogy. That is just, I have them, and I've tried to read them on several different occasions. It's just, there's just so much story going on there with so many different groups of people that I just couldn't do it because it was so dense. I felt like I was trying to read the Silmarillion all over again.
I looked up the wiki entry on Memory Beta for those articles, and, like, the summary of the plot was so long, I could not get through it. I was like, all right, I'm going to read the plot
summary.
There's a
lot there.
And I was like, oh my goodness, I might as well just go read the book. There's so much here.
I mean, because first we're like 2380, then we're back in like 2168.
Yeah, there was a lot of time jumping.
With an Enterprise captain, and then we're, or an Enterprise era captain, excuse me.
Yeah.
And then we're in the 16th century, it's just like, what is going on here? Like, wow. I mean, there's a story there, it has to do with this race called the Calari, I think is what they're called.
Yeah.
And there's the Borg are involved. And such.
What aren't the Borg involved in these days?
Not what Riker's doing, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I mean, they're handling another part of the Quadrant anyway. But the whole trilogy results in the Borg being dealt like some serious blow or being wiped out or some such.
Oh, man, if I had a nickel for every time they wiped out the Borg.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd have at least 15 cents.
Yeah.
Because it's been done at least three or four times.
Gotcha. But yeah, but anyway, overall, I do like the Titan series. I do recommend it to people. Now, one of the things that we touched on earlier was the Star Wars Extended Universe a little bit, and how the Star Trek novels don't have that sort of thing for the shows and series, at least. Like, you can't watch, like, TNG and the movies, all that, and then go read, like, TNG novels and go, yeah, this stuff is, you know, all part of the same timeline. It's very much not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question I have for you is, do you think should we have an extended universe?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because the extended universe is a complete failure in terms of they try to make everything match up, but it doesn't. And basically, it just sets a false expectation that everything will match up, and it never does. And it really confines the stories you can tell, because you have to, like... It means that when you want to write a Star Wars novel, you have to, like, do all this checking and make sure that you're not contradicting something some other Star Wars novel did. And there are so many millions of Star Wars novels. And then George Lucas makes a bunch of prequel movies and makes everything that was written in the extended universe non-canon anyway. the extended universe is a mess.
Uh-huh.
And it leads to all kinds of horrible flame wars on forums where people are trying to argue these two, like, what actually happened in these two stories, because they're supposed to be congruent, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it leads to these huge arguments. It's way easier just to say these novels are all self-contained. And if they want to be, if you want to have two writers who want to have their novel series coincide, like what Destiny did, which, granted, it doesn't sound like Destiny did it very well, but if...
No, I don't have a problem with tie-in stuff.
But if you want to tie in two novel series, you totally can, but the idea of trying to create a whole other, like, section of canon for novels, which are by definition way more disparate and non-contiguous than a television show is,
mm-hmm.
I just think that that's a losing battle right from the start, and I don't see the point. I don't see what it gains you, other than it, like, really all it does is confine the types of stories you can tell. Because, like, for example, in the Star Wars novels, like, Luke could never get a romance interest. He always had to be a bachelor. Because, like, every other novelist wanted their chance to have a romance with Luke, which meant that at the end of every story, he had to break up with whatever his girlfriend was that month. And it wasn't until they finally made the decision to pair him off with Mara Jade, who then died so he could continue to be the most eligible bachelor. And I don't know, maybe they stopped after Mara Jade died. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read past that point. But, you know, because in the Star Wars universe, everything has to stay kind of the same so that all of the continuity can be maintained. None of the characters ever get a chance to grow and change, which is incidentally why there was such a huge backlash to Chewbacca dying. Because for so long, nothing had changed, and then suddenly we're like, we're going to kill Chewie now, in, like, a way that wasn't even very good. And so it was like, whereas if the novels could be different, and, like, didn't have to take that from each other, it would be so much better, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad there's no Star Trek Extended Universe. I hope they never try to institute one, because I think that would be a lost cause. And honestly, I don't know who would do it, since the Star Wars, since the Star Trek franchise is held by at least two different companies, different parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which
Paramount's the movies, and the CBS has the shows.
Yeah, exactly. And the franchise on that, like, changes hands more often than I care to think about. It's not like Lucas, where, like, you know, in Star Wars, Lucas has control of everything, and he's not going to die anytime soon. Whereas Star Trek has no clear line of succession. It's not clear who will own Star Trek any day from now.
Right.
But anyway, so yeah, that's why I feel like they would be a waste of time.
Yeah. Now, another question I want to ask you was, do you think the books, whether we had an extended universe set up, or if it was what it was now, still, if it remains that way, where it's just, you know, a bunch of different little self-contained stories or tie-in novels and whatnot, or own little universes. There's actually the pocket universe, actually, which is the pocketbook stuff.
Right.
All that stuff is supposed to be taking place in the same universe and whatnot. Do you think most of them should be just purely entertainment, or do you think a lot of them should still bring up a lot of the social issues and political issues that we saw in TNG, DS9?
God, I hope they do.
Kind of Voyager a little bit, maybe.
I mean, I think that Star Trek should make you think. I think it should bring up issues and difficult choices and interesting situations. I don't think it always will, and I'm certainly not saying that every Star Trek novel that you write has to have some kind of deeper political message. But Star Trek, when at its best, has always been thinking man sci-fi, and it's made you think. And at its worst, it's been, like, mindless action. You know, always at its worst is when it's mindless action.
Yep.
Obviously, with the exception of the new, with some exceptions, the new movie is pretty good, even though it's fairly mindless.
New movie's pretty much entertainment.
Yeah. But, like, so that's what sort of separates Star Trek from other sci-fi franchises, is that it is actually making you think about various things. And, you know, that was what it was when it first started. It was, like, that was its big thing. And I think that losing, like, you know, the bringing up of issues and different political ideas and, you know, even non-political ideas, philosophical ideas even. I think if Star Trek doesn't do that, we lose something very fundamental about Star Trek, and I would certainly like to see that in novels. And so, yeah, that's, I guess that answers the question.
Bam.
Is yes. I love it. All right, so if we're done with that, I actually want to, I forgot to at the beginning of this podcast, update everyone on the stories of the USS Compass.
Oh man, the Compass, woo!
Because I actually, so we're going to end with that. So I'm very proud of the crew of the Compass. In their last session, both the captain couldn't make it to the game, and I incapacitated the first officer right quick.
Oh my goodness.
And so the third officer, or second officer, excuse me, Lieutenant Commander Yetta, played by my good friend Kelsey, who you may have heard as Glenn Ekman on this show. She rose to the occasion and took command quite handily, and I put them in a scenario that I actually kind of got the idea from Dear Doctor, which is that really stupid episode of Enterprise where they let a civilization die off. But the idea being that, like, you have one civilization that's dying, but, like, to save it, you might end up dooming another civilization. And so it was, you know, they were wrestling with this very difficult moral decision, and then, like, at the same time, like, part of working into that was my Trill Science officer having to flash back to his previous life to get information, and then we had this real, we actually had a guest star. My friend Jim came in and played a counselor to help him through that, and that was, look, okay, we're not going to talk about that part of his character, but that was really fun, and they had a rugby game, and I've been slowly trying to...
We won the rugby game, they lost the rugby game.
Yep, just bleeding all of your courage points on rugby game.
Hey, those are two-thirds of my courage points well spent.
Yep. So yeah, I was very proud of the crew of the Compass, and I'm excited to see what they deal with tomorrow. But
I'm excited to see what we deal with tomorrow.
Yeah, all right. Now I just have to go plan.
No, man.
I got nothing. All right. And with that, I think we will end this session. This is Oren.
What are we talking about next week?
Huh? Oh, right. Next week, we are talking about Voyager and their Let's Get Home plots.
Now, what do you mean, get home plots, exactly?
You remember...
Isn't that the plot of the series?
No. What I mean specifically is that there are a bunch of Voyager episodes, starting very early in the show, where they find some kind of thing that, if it goes correctly, they could get home.
Oh, okay.
And you lose track of how many of those there are, so I won't talk about them.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, this is Oren and Bob signing off.